Welcome to the Connected Commute podcast from Bolden Networks. Bolden Networks is unlocking the power of an interconnected future by bringing you insights in transport from around the globe. I'm Ian Montgomery of Label Sessions, and today Chris Bichette at Bolden and myself are talking to Fiona Purcell. Fiona is a chartered civil engineer with over 25 years of experience, focusing on design leadership in complex projects with Arup as their associate director. In our work around the future of stations as it is related to connectivity, Arup's white papers on stations relating more to the physical environment were a huge source of inspiration to us. Fiona is currently at the forefront of the rail sector and its future, currently developing stations as part of a massive project in California, while being able to reflect on her experiences in the likes of Toronto, London, and Saudi Arabia.
Today, our guest is Fiona Purcell. Welcome, Fiona.
Thank you very much.
Quiet Connected Transit podcast. Fiona, you are an associate principal at Arup. I'll leave it to you to tell us what Arup does and what an associate principal does, if you don't mind.
Arup is a multinational design house. I think we can say we have, I'm lucky enough to work with, you know, some of the best designers, engineers, specialists in all sectors of design, and we look after infrastructure projects, buildings projects, healthcare, science industry, technology, and it's an amazing company. I've worked with them for 26 years, and I think I'm probably on around my third career within Arup. Having started as a graduate engineer with them in Ireland, and I've been lucky enough to work in four countries, and most in the last 10 or so years, I've started to lead complex projects, particularly transportation projects, with a particular focus on train stations and the complexity that comes with that.
Specializing in train stations. What a coincidence.
I know.
You're just the person we'd like to talk to. That's fantastic. And I earlier described you as perhaps not a world famous person, but exactly the person we want to talk to, because you're working away behind the scenes, making sometimes subtle, sometimes dramatic changes that affect millions of people and how they travel. And we want to dig into that today. So you see, you've worked on a number of major projects. You said four different countries. I know of, you're in the United States now. You're in San Francisco.
On the West Coast, that's it. I've worked in London, spent close on 10 years in London. Yeah. Worked in Toronto for about a year and a half. And now on the West Coast of the US.
I saw the note about you having worked in Canada. And if you were working in Canada on rail, I just want to say, you're not done yet. There's a lot of work still to be done.
There is. Yeah, an amazing, I think we're living through an amazing time at the minute where there is, a refocus on railways and huge investment going to the rail systems globally. It's, I think, seen a recognition of the importance that, you know, that railway stations and rail lines bring to communities, connecting people. So yeah, I think it's a really exciting time to be in the industry. And as you said, can be transformational in terms of the work we do and the impact we can have on people's lives.
There definitely is a renaissance, particularly around rail. It was interesting, one of our previous guests was saying, He is a strong lobbyist for bringing, you know, increasing transit, particularly rail, getting better rail services. But all he's striving for is to get to where things were about 60 or 80 years ago. Because during, particularly in North America, during our growing up, we ripped out a whole lot of rail services. Everybody in America and coast to coast in Canada got around. So much movement of people and goods by rail, and we ripped that all out again, and now we're trying to rebuild it back.
Everybody, I think, with the, you know, where we're at in terms of climate change and sort of realization of the role and the responsibility that we have to look after our planet. You know, rail is one of the means of helping to connect people, which has been so important in the last century or so, and the, you know, the prosperity and the innovation that has come with that. I think there's a realization now that, okay, maybe we haven't been doing that connectivity maybe quite the right way, and sort of a chance to look back and see, okay, maybe we were onto something, you know, at the turn of the 18th, 19th century, that, you know, rail was and still is hugely beneficial to our communities. And yeah, it's exciting to see it now reemerge and have a renaissance, as you said.
Rail certainly has that benefit to our communities, but your specialization is in stations. And I'm curious to get your take on stations. We published a white paper, and one of the opening lines we borrowed from somewhere else was that the stations are the pearls in the necklace of the railway. And, you know, around here, a lot of stations are places just where people get off and on and off the train. And there's certainly cultural influences that affect that and affect those perceptions of what a rail station is supposed to do. I think we have grander visions over here of what the rail station should be. What is yours and Arup's take on what to make of a rail station? I say rail, but we should say transit.
Totally agree. I think for me, there's no right answer to, let's call it a transport hub or a kind of connection point. Every location is different. Every need is different. And I think there isn't one correct answer. I think we've got to really think about what we're trying to do, what is the aims and ambitions that we're trying to meet, and sort of start at that point rather than a preconceived, oh, let's do this and then see how it fits into the community. So if I look at, say, the work I've worked on high-speed stations and I've worked on metros, the answer ultimately that you might come up with for both those might be quite different, whether there's dealing more with, you know, regular people who just want to get into their destination as quickly as they possibly can, to people where this is a, you know, a one-off journey, each station. And that's why I love doing the job I do. You know, every project is different and unique. And I think we to do as good a job we can. And, you know, we've quite a responsibility in terms of the designs that we develop to make sure that they really serve the communities that, you know, that have helped fund it and invest in it. So there's no perfect sort of one answer. I think the thing is to try and get the station to serve as many people in as good a way as we possibly can.
I would agree. I think there's no universal answer. We've tried to look at all the various types of stations you describe and boil them down to a stereotype of a handful of categories, but there's a lot of variety. And while there's no universal answer, we think a lot of it could be done better in many places, but not every solution, not every feature will apply equally in every station. So you get a lot of variety in your job, I would imagine. Tasks.
Absolutely. So whether you look at, you know, a city center location or a completely new sort of site that, you know, might be the catalyst for a future city, to, you know, something that is in the suburbs, to something that is, you know, right at the heart of a, you know, a downtown area. So yeah, all different. The needs are different. The other wonderful thing is, you know, to me, train stations are this collision of, you know, this longitudinal network with, you know, with a nodal point, and you know, the site around the station, I think, is equally important to the, you know, the station building itself. So it's hugely varied, hugely complex, but yeah, never a dull moment in trying to figure out, right, what do we think is, on balance, the overall best solution for you know, a particular location.
So you would agree then that stations are, there are differences. There are the small stations in downtown that get packed and you really just want to move people as quickly as possible. But to a large degree, they're community hubs.
Exactly. And I think we are realizing now more and more the importance of having those community hubs. And you know what, to me, what's quite exciting at the minute is we're at a point where we can, you know, imagine what these might be in the future. So and you know, the can these be, you know, 24/7 locations that vary and transform throughout the day, you know, and really challenge our thinking of what a train station might be. You know, the world is changing rapidly, and it opens up opportunities, I think, to how we think about stations and the potential and opportunities that there are.
One of our, I would call it our Bible in this discussion, in this project, is Transport for Humans by Pete Dyson and Roy Sutherland. And they are big behavioral science advocates. Eric published a paper in 2020 called The Future of Stations. And one of the first lines in that is, design for users, not functions. And is that the philosophy that drives Arup's station design?
Yeah, absolutely. The, you know, mostly I would say these are big public, you know, public funded enterprises, and you know, the client is the user at the end of the day. And I think one of the terms that I love is sort of human-centered design. So, and knowing that we're not all alike, we all have different sort of needs and abilities, and making sure that we, you know, we really now think about all the different people that might be using and maybe in the past haven't been able to use sort of stations. How can we open up the world to make it more accessible for you know, more of the population? So yeah, I think it's critical. Yeah,
that paper had a number of wonderful observations that, not so coincidentally, align with our thinking as well. Wayfinding is a big feature in there. I always call out, you know, the Houston station has been around for over 180 years, and you still can't tell me the best door to walk out in a station. So wayfinding is a recurring one that nobody's found the panacea to that. But there are a number of different features through the paper, including urban regeneration. The station should be a factor in fixing the urban centers. And by the way, the Toronto Path got a call out in that paper, so thanks for that too. I'm sitting above it right now, the largest underground path in the world, because it is minus 9 degrees Celsius here right now, so we Canadians tend to stay underground.
Yeah, and I've used it, and if you were to say, you know, wayfinding, how important it is, that, you know, there's improvement certainly that can be made, you know, in terms of orienting people, and the idea, you know, that we really try and foster in when we're designing stations is kind of as much as possible, try and make it intuitive that you know where you should be going, as well, and then supporting that by whether it is signage and now digital, you know, there's digital opportunities now, you know, that we're seeing come on the horizon. So I think it's a combination of different design opportunities that can, I think, really help. So that, you know, that when you arrive disoriented potentially into a new city.
Exactly. And we have identified newcomers, tourists, immigrants to a new place as the most underserved population in transit. They come there and their first time in the transit station, you just don't know what to do. And, you know, we have signage that sometimes takes you down a path and then orphans you, just cuts you off with no further idea where to go and how to buy a ticket and all that sort of thing. We're turning our attention to trying to plug that gap in some of the services that we offer.
I think there's a huge amount of improvement that we can do. And it's complicated, you know, you're trying to come up with something that serves a whole array of people, because it's not a homogenous, you know, group of people that are using.
And it's complicated and it's multifaceted, but some helpful solutions are actually really simple and are just overlooked. Because they're thrown to the engineers instead of the behavioral scientists. I think that's been shown again and again. And you know, you can watch just about half of Rory Sutherland's speeches and he'll have a zing that he wants to throw at transit. So we're not thinking straight about that.
To me, it's harnessing the best of all these specialists. So it's, you know, it's making sure that we bring, and I think my role in particular on stations design is to make sure we're bringing all these specialists together, and that overall we're trying to come up with what the overall best solution is. You know, it's not one part of the profession that has answered everything. We really need all of these technical specialists to come together in a unified way.
So you've had an extensive career. You must have some really good stories. You must have some projects that you worked on that were particularly interesting, and that you made changes to and came away really proud. And I'm not looking for the most grandiose. Some of them, I'll bet you worked on some projects and did some subtle little change that increased the passenger movement efficiency by 45%, and you patted yourself on the back and nobody else in the world noticed, just that things got smoother. Have you got any good stories of successes like that?
I don't think I can take claim to any of the good. role is really to try and inspire, you know, the designers to come up and push them to think outside the box. I think for me, some of them.
You don't want to hang your name on it. We call that being Canadian. Yeah, come on, we can drop the humility and the you know, the shyness. Just you surely worked on a project that you thought was really cool.
I think all the projects I work on are really cool. So
good answer. Good answer.
Yeah, no, they all are amazing. I did one of the, and it's under construction at the minute, so it's not fully realized in Metro in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. We had one incredibly complex metro station for various reasons. It was highly complicated, and just bringing the team together to get everything that we needed for two metro lines intersected, two separate contracts, coming up with overall design that sort of worked on a super constrained site with, you know, two quite separate connections from two different lines. I'm really excited to see that station come to reality. I think it's going to be really, really amazing. It's slowly taking shape. So I think that station is going to be hopefully one to watch. And I think in particular around the wayfinding on that, the team did an amazing job And again, that's the use of color to help guide people in the finishes, help guide people sort of to where they should be, using natural light again to guide people to know where they should be going. I think that's going to be an absolute stunning station. So that's one that I'm really excited to see come to life.
I know a little bit about transit in Saudi Arabia, and I would characterize parts of it as magnificent. I would imagine there's a lot of technology being used. I imagine there's ample funding to put into these projects, and a lot of technology goes into them. Can you describe some of the things that will emerge from the unveiling of this new station?
What's interesting, so these railway station designs, they take a long time to design because they're so complex. So what was an innovation, 8, 9, 10 years ago when we were starting it, it was one of the, from how we designed it, it was all done in 3D. The design team all worked in a unified model, and we used the model. So that was, at the time, that was cutting edge. Now it's the norm. So it's hard to think back what was cutting edge at the time. And I think one of the challenges we have now is thinking, okay, we've got to just keep pushing that, and we have a great opportunity to keep seeing, as new digital innovations come on board, how can we harness that and to really see whether it's looking at so much of the population now are digital natives. But we also have people where, that isn't a comfortable environment, and we need to design for both. So I think there's, the whole digital area and what that can bring, how that can both help us in the design process to realize better designs, but also I think in terms of the user experience in the stations as well, I think is a really exciting arena. And I think every project we do, I think the impact of what we can do digitally, it's just compounding all the time, improving hopefully what we're doing as a result.
Can you think of an example maybe where there were the principle of designing for people, for users instead of functions, where that technology that surely is pretty advanced there has improved the user experience, improved the passenger experience?
So I think one thing that I've seen, which 10 years ago wasn't really being talked about as much, is the looking at personas. So trying to test the design and really turn on the head how we do our design, rather than start with the building and work down to the person at the end, start the other way around, starting with the person and working up. So,
and not designing for the average.
Exactly.
The average expected behavior.
Exactly, yeah. So that we don't have this, nobody's satisfied because we've kind of hit the, one prototype person that, and I think that's where the advances from a digital point of view is, we can now do that much, much quicker. We can do multiple people. We can test multiple scenarios. If you take, say, the pedestrian flow as one area, which is I see as sort of advancing, and it I think has always been on that cutting edge, and it continues to advance, is just how people move through stations. Where are the and I think this is where kind of engineering hits behavioral science to me, and the whole pedestrian flow is a brilliant example of that. How do people actually react when they come to a bottom of an escalator or you know, and or they stop because they can't see the sign, you know, what, you know, all of those impacts, which, you know, are, you know, cause a backlog, and people, you know, don't know why they, you know, there's a congestion on the, on platforms or, so I think that's one area that is really pushing, pushing the possibilities of what we can do. And as a result, hopefully our stations, when they come on stream, then, you know, run smoother and yeah, really are more suitable for all of the different types of users that will be using them.
I think that's a key important distinction, that people don't always respond the way we expect them to respond. That model of how we expect them to respond, Dyson and Sutherland call that Homo transporticus, where design in the past has been built around the way humans should respond, but behavioral science tells us humans don't respond in the same way or the same manner. There are other influences that we failed to factor in. So I appreciate the idea of working from personas. There was also Ian with us here pulled out a quote from someone who said, if you get all those, roughly speaking, if you get those personas and you figure out the extremes, if you build to the extremes, you get the middle for free. And so that's a good way to be inclusive, accessible, all these different things that are hot topics right now as the population gets older. And
I count myself as being very lucky, is I get to work with wayfinding experts, with pedestrian planning experts, with behavioral scientists, and kind of bringing all of those together to say, okay, how do we do this better? This is what we've done. Where are the problems? How can we learn from that? How can we constantly improve? And, you know, we have amazing tools now at our fingertips. How can we make the most of those? Learn from different industries, I think, is another key thing that we, you know, can really help our station designs to be better.
That sounds like so much fun to me, hanging out with those people. Can I come hang out with you for a couple weeks? Follow you around?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That would be amazing.
A very privileged position that I have. And yeah, it's an amazing sort of the role I do. So design lead, which is kind of sitting, trying to get the best out of, push people to see, right, can we do this better? Have we done this better in a different, you know, a different sector, a different business? How can we kind of solve the problems that are kind of, and challenges that we're faced with to come up?
So where do you get your ideas? You don't want to do what's been done for the last 60 years. Maybe you want to improve on those things. So where do you get your ideas?
I think just keeping your eyes open to me is, you know, and, you know, trying to think, don't be constrained in our thinking of, you know, how we might, I think, allow ourselves to dream a little bit and imagine, well, what might we be do? Don't be constrained by, oh, well, we haven't done it before, so maybe we can't do it. So I think that is trying to harness the, you know, the art of the possible. So again, this is where working with, you know, amazing designers and engineers who could, when, you know, you put a challenge, well, could we do it? Is there a way we could do it? And, you know, encouraging those engineers love solving problems. So if we put a challenge to them about, well, how might we do it? If, you know, it is amazing how the solutions that come out. So but I think, to me, it's looking around, seeing how, oh, that's interesting, you know, and see, oh, we could use that to solve this, and being just open, I think, to borrowing from other sectors, other areas, and just seeing, okay, how could we use that, and encouraging, you know, all of our teams. I don't think any one person has all of the answers. And I think some of the best ideas can come from anybody and not necessarily in their kind of core discipline. So it might be, you know, somebody who doesn't know something to say, oh, well, why can't we do that? Because they don't have the kind of maybe the all of the years of learning and that behind and the baggage yet to say, oh, no, of course, we never do that. We couldn't. So, so bringing all these people together into the room, I think, can really where we can find some of our best innovations.
I was going to say, there's this great story about the pantograph on the Japanese Shinkansen around they couldn't find a way of making it more aerodynamic and reliable at higher speeds. And some guy who worked for Japanese railways was like, or maybe Hitachi or one of the train building companies was like, really into bird watching. So basically he looked at like the flight of very fast birds when they were swooping and then like brought that into the design of the pantograph, and that meant the train could go faster. But I think there's something interesting around, you get environments where, I'll pick on ad agencies, they think a creative has to come up with a creative idea. I think a lot of engineering firms, like, they don't necessarily allow psychology into how they design for a solution, but really great firms actually have that diversity of thinking. So I'd love to learn a little bit about how do you make sure that the engineer isn't poo-pooed because he's got an engineering solution, at the same time as someone who's thinking more like a psychologist is, we're going to build this thing so it's structurally sound, but we're also going to build this thing so that it exists for the people who are going to use it.
To me, it's all about giving people the opportunity to voice their and the confidence to come up with ideas. So giving people, no matter how many, if they're, you know, just a graduate or, you know, with, you know, 30 years of experience, you know, I think anybody can come up with a good idea. We all use the world. So, you know, to me, the ideas can come from anywhere. And I think not putting people into boxes, I think is really important. Yes, ultimately, the work needs to be designed meticulously and that. But actually, when we're doing that kind of blue sky thinking and the coming up with those brainstorming ideas, it's to make sure we have a diversity of thinking. So, in the widest possible way, you know, I think making sure our design teams are diverse and reflect society, but also have a diversity in terms of who's at the table and the different expertise that's around the table as well.
This podcast is brought to you by Bolden Networks, unlocking the power of an interconnected future. We're delivering the advanced shared network infrastructures needed for a smart, inclusive, and sustainable future. From interconnected transit to venues, enterprises to smart cities, we're creating new possibilities in the way people live, work, and play. To find out more, visit bolden.com.
I imagine the gathering of these ideas involves a lot of talking with passengers too. Formal systems for doing that, or Andy Byford used to sit on the train in Toronto and New York and London with his name badge on.
Oh, brilliant.
Talk to anybody who had words for him. He commuted in on the transit system every day.
Yeah.
And got feedback directly. Some more colorful than others, I imagine.
Yeah, I imagine. And I think it's probably an area, I think, that we can all do more of and kind of make sure that we're not only the users, but the people impacted by stations. So I think it's, we need to really make sure that, you know, we're really engaging with all stakeholders on these projects. And it's, you know, whether it's the people who are disrupted by the, you know, the construction and the building of some of these, to actually the end user who will be using it. So particularly in cities and city communities. And I think going back to this idea about the stations having the potential to be community hubs in the future, I think that we need to just keep reminding ourselves that actually it's not just the user of the rail service, but it might be the person who comes in to, buy a sandwich or, use the, the public realm around the station. You know, those are equally important. And I think it's an area that we could always do more of. And I think we need to, challenge ourselves to make sure that we are thinking about all the people who are sort of impacted.
We've done a lot of talking with people directly, and I found for my needs, Ian's British accent translates well in Canada and the U.S., and he gets a lot of feedback. But when he does it in the U.K., the response he usually gets is one or two notches short of violence. So, but that brings it. That's a good segue into you having worked in four different countries, North America and Europe. You must have observed some significant cultural differences yourself firsthand and in your work related to the perception of transit, the needs in stations, the funding available.
Yeah, I think it's really, to me, it's really interesting. You know, the solution that works in London or say to the west coast of the US where I am at the minute, even if everything else was the same, culturally they're quite different. So the end answer, to serve both societies actually might be quite different. And down to, some of the cultural differences. So I think we've just to acknowledge that all cultures aren't the same and that, one culture doesn't have all of the answers so I think, again, it's going back to the last point about listening to the people who are impacted, will be using the service, so in the particular location. And making sure that we don't think just because something worked somewhere else that it necessarily will work in a different location. So I think,
Conversely, do you see any aspirations for sort of, working toward modeling the other side? Do you see people maybe saying, that over there looks really great and we should try and do that here? Obviously, some ideas would be easier than others, and some would require a cultural shift.
Yeah.
But do you? I sense there's more international discussion going on.
Yeah.
And people observing some really good successful things and trying a little bit harder
for stations designs. There's so many amazing examples of railway stations around the world. There's also amazing examples of terrible railway stations around the world, and I think we can learn a lot from both.
You know where this is leading, right? You said that. I'm going to put you on the spot, Shirley.
Similar to how we make sure that we are bringing all different experts together, we should also look all around the world and see where are things working, where are things not working, what's good, what's bad, and benchmarking and taking advantage of where people have really got it right before and see, right, will that translate to a different location? Will that work?
In terms of stations, who is really doing it right? Who blows you away with what they've done and how they consistently manage quality and catering to the needs of, we've identified five key stakeholder groups. The biggest one we think is passengers, but who's doing it right to cater to the needs of everybody involved? You have an answer, you just don't want to throw it out there, right?
then of course Arab.
which geography or which transit organization do you think is doing it right now?
So, and again, I haven't visited all of these, but I think two summers ago, I went interrailing around France, and the French rail system is amazing. They have some amazing stations, but they've also some terrible stations. But just how normal that service is and how well used that service is incredible. And they have harnessed some of that awe-inspiring, some of the older, grander stations of the past, which is fantastic, but not appropriate everywhere. So I think I was in Oslo and Sweden, in Stockholm again. Interesting bits, some bits. I don't know whether there's one perfect station that you can say, oh, everybody's got everything right. But I think in Oslo, there's a beautiful station there, connecting up with the airport to the city center. And that comes right into the heart of Oslo city center.
Just the last 10 minutes on the train into Oslo is amazing. It's fantastic. And then station is really great too. Yeah.
And how simple it is to get on and off and out of those stations, I think is really, really, really interesting. You know, so even something simple like their ticket gates are, staggered all along the station, and super simple to get in and out. It's not, it's not this big queuing at the end. So I think that's something that I saw recently that I went, that's a really smart way of doing it. I haven't traveled to Japan. I was due to go to visit, but COVID hit, so unfortunately I didn't manage to make it. But I'd love to see how. I think I have to organize a holiday there so I can go visit some of their stations. I'd love to see. I'm sure there's amazing, and similarly in China, I'm sure there's some amazing stations there that I haven't seen. So
the Chinese ones are really interesting. Like there's this quote by Jules Goddard. He's like a London Business School professor, but he talks about, like, he hates the term best practice, because he says it's like best practice results in formulaic sameness. But there's something about the Chinese stations, like, they're all quite boring. Like, they're not particularly interesting to look at. They all follow a kind of blueprint, but they all, like, work really, really functionally well. And they're just gigantic, phenomenal pieces of engineering, but they're a bit soulless. But, like, Japanese stations then have, like, jingles when you're, like, so each station on the Tokyo subway has its own unique crafted jingle written mostly by one guy. So the stations have this immediate sense of personality. And, like, the Stockholm ones all look beautiful. But if everything looked like that, it would be boring.
Exactly.
So I feel like it's this sense of you have to mix and match it, but know when to mix and match it. And that's maybe where the big opportunity we have.
Yeah, I just love to see stations that are being used and by a diversity of people, so I think if we can achieve that, we're doing pretty, pretty well. And that they're spaces that people like and feel comfortable in, feel safe in, if we manage to inspire people as well, in the process, even better. So I love the, pulling into or out of St. Pancras and that, majestic sort of space. To me, that's awe-inspiring, but not something that you can do everywhere or suitable for doing everywhere.
So taking all these ideas and all this experience of you, you're working on stations today. What's at the cutting edge of what you're doing today? What I imagine the stations you're working on today are going to be high tech and have new innovations that you're working on, some of which you may not even be able to tell us about right now. Where are we going with all the new technology and all the cool and fun stuff?
Cool and fun stuff. I think to me, the biggest challenge that I'm facing or trying to get my head around at the minute is I'm right at the very early stages of a high speed project, and just seeing how we can use stations to connect communities, use the actual station building itself to connect the communities in the centers where the station are, which have been, you know, previously cut off by whether it's railways or highways, and use the stations nearly as a kind of healing piece to reconnect some of those communities. To me, that is a real challenge, which is more of physical than a technology piece. But I think technology will come to play in that. I think from a digital point of view, we're still designing for ticket gates. I think there's how that evolves over the next period of time will have a big impact on our stations. So I think that's one area in particular, how that we've to design for the now, but the stations are, you know, they're massive investments. They need to be good for in 100 years' time. They need to be equally good. So, you know, we need to make sure that the design is adaptable so that it makes sense into the future, right? And part of it is saying, okay, what if we don't have fare gates? How would the station work then? And so that we can sort of make sure it's fit for purpose day one, but also try and imagine what it might be like in the future as well, so we can make sure that it makes sense when hopefully ticket gates are a thing of the past.
I imagine the aging population factors heavily into the future planning of stations as well.
Absolutely, and I think this comes down to, you know, the personas that we were talking about and listening to some of your previous guests. I think it was, so you had some really interesting discussions around that, and, you know, the making sure that our stations are usable by all demographics, I think is really, really important. Making sure we whether it's, as you talked about before, wayfinding, making sure, you know, there's enough, we're not making people walk for, you know, kilometers at a time to get to their...
Like
their,
most airports.
Yeah, yeah. So how can we do that better, you know, for, you know, if people aren't hugely mobile? You know, if I look at some high-speed trains are incredibly long, they're like 400 meters long. That is a long way to walk if you're not hugely comfortable on your feet. So how do we make that journey easier for people? What innovations can we come up with to try? And, you know, whether it's something simple like, let's just provide some more seating along the way so people can take a break. Or is there something more, radical that we need to do to make sure that our stations are designed to suit all. Sometimes we're great at overcomplicating things when the simple can be the answer. I think, Ian, you in one of your past shows, you were mentioning how all you need is a shelf.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't need to be a hugely high-tech solution, actually just something simple. And I think reminding ourselves that, you know, actually the best answer might be the really obvious, simple answer.
Ian and I both crave shelving, but for different reasons.
there's something interesting around that. We had it, I think it was actually my dad when he was on, but he was talking about like bus infrastructure of like, you can have the nicest electric bus, but if you don't have the lanes and the stops and the system designed in the right way, it's kind of pointless. So actually you have to design these systems around, like, you can have the best Wi-Fi, but there's nowhere to open a laptop, it doesn't work. You can have the fastest train, but if it takes you an age to get on and off of it and out the station, you're defeating the point of the great engineering. I think that that's the magic about how you design these things for the future.
Exactly, yeah.
So, Fiona, I said I was going to put you on the spot, so here it is. You've seen a lot of stations, you've talked to a lot of people, you've found some really innovative things. What stands out to you as a really cool station and is at the top of your list? And also, if there was one that you could offer some volunteer air up time to, which one would that be?
So I'm going to start with two stations, though very different. So I was in Budapest a few years ago, and they have their original metro system, which is one of the oldest in the world, was started around the turn of the 18th, 19th century. And their stations are amazing. They are incredibly small, and it is so simple. There's a certain beauty about the simplicity of their stations. I think we sometimes can hugely overcomplicate, because we now can, with all of the tools at our disposal, we can hugely overcomplicate them. But I think in terms of looking back also to what was done before, I think we can learn a lot. So there it is, you know, they're just below the surface. You just come downstairs and there you are. Super simple, and you hop on the train and you're away. So I think in terms of low impact in an area, I think there's something quite beautiful about those.
Less is more.
Yeah. And then on the other scale, I do love St. Pancras, that grand hall. I think a reimagining of some of our old sort of building stock, particularly looking at, you know, making sure that, you know, in terms of reuse and regeneration of our building stock, it's really important. I think that is a beautiful, beautiful building. To me, it inspires me every time I go into it. It's just an inspiring space. And I think if we look back at all of the, we don't need to, you know, destroy what was done before. I think there's a lot of beautiful buildings that we can restore and bring back to life, and hopefully make sort of enhance them so that they're good for another 100 years. So I think I haven't visited it, but I like the Calatrava, again in that kind of awe-inspiring structure in Liège. I think that's quite interesting, but I haven't visited it, so I don't know actually on the day-to-day how
I went there.
Yeah.
I went there, but I literally went to Liège to go see that station.
Yeah.
This is how sad I am.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's very cold, though.
It looks very transparent, which is good, but I imagine, yes, that might result in it being a bit cold. But
it looks amazing, but like, you don't, when your Deutsche Bahn train is coming in late, not great.
Yeah, not you don't want to be sitting around shivering on the platform. So I think, yeah, so those are some of the stations. I do also love Baker Street, the old original tube station, in particular the platform on the old original Baker Street tube line as well. I think there's something quite beautiful about that as well.
I've been there a number of times. I still can't figure out which exit I want to take to get where I want.
True. It's not flawless, but I think as an environment that, you know, the use of textures and that, I think the use of materials and what materials we choose, I think, can have a big impact on the feel of the spaces. And I think that's one where the original brick arches are just stunningly beautiful.
And the second half of my question:
there's a lot of stations, just going back to your wayfinding, that could benefit from just a very small little bit of time on wayfinding. That would enhance a lot of people's, with very small intervention, could probably sort of benefit hugely. Where I know our team in New York is working at the minute on Penn Expansion Station, and I haven't also visited the original or Penn Station, but I imagine that there's parts of that maybe that could could do it in enhancing. I think our team is working hard on that.
I've been there many times and I fully support that one.
Yeah. In Toronto, you touched on the path, and you know that's an amazing network. I think how that integrates with the stations, I think there's something there that could be even better than what it is at the minute. And it's kind of two things that have nearly collided at the minute: time and sort of engagement with the people who use it, to see. I think there's something there that could be quite interesting as well.
Well, I will say that Union Station, I don't know when you were living here, but Union Station has been under construction. I'm not an accurate resource for this. Nobody hold me to it, but I'd have to say over 10 years. And a lot of the construction walls and so on have recently come down. And Union Station has come a long way. And we had a previous guest who said it was one of his favorite stations.
Yeah, I think there's, I don't know it before. So I was in Toronto sort of around 21. It still, parts of it were under construction, but parts of it had also been opened up. And yeah, there's some really beautiful bits. The old hall as well is beautiful there. But the new, some of the new part of the station again is really good. And it's quite vast, but it's quite simple as well in some respects. So I think that's been done, yeah, really quite well.
I'm not sure there's a station in the world where the building is so big, but so little space is given to getting on or off the train, which makes it quite interesting.
I find the platform widths are incredibly, for the size of the trains that you're standing beside. I find it quite uncomfortable standing on, you know, you're standing at wheel, right at the train wheel height, and the platforms are very narrow, yeah, compared to what I'd be used to in Europe, it's quite different.
Or the North American practice of lining up to get on a train because they don't consider it safe to stand on the platform, which is, again, quite strange.
Well, to Fiona's point, maybe it's not as safe to stand on the platform over here. But I think that they converge about six different transit types, different types of trains and buses and so on. And it is vast and sprawling, but at least now you can get from one end to the other without walking outdoors, which in minus 10 is welcome. But those walls have come down, though, that you were talking about, and a lot of retail has opened up there. And it appears to be retail that's actively used. and you know, not just something that is not quite fitting to the environment. So you see that in Montreal a lot, where the station downtown is integrated right downtown, and you can go and you can get some, you know, a baguette or some dinner or whatever on your way home, and that's more, I think, I would call that more Europe coming to North America, where it's integrated into the community.
One of the things that I think is lovely about stations, and something that I think we had started to lose, but it's coming back again, is like a unique identity to each of the stations, that maybe there's some comfort in sameness, but I think also there's a huge opportunity for the cities or the towns or locations to, you know, make them a bit unique, and you know, also act as attractors for people to you know, visit different locations. So it's, you know, not the same you know, coffee shop or whatever on every single station, in the exact same position in every single station, that actually a bit of uniqueness that, you know, as people pass through, they go, oh, this looks, maybe I'll get off the train next time at this station. And I think there's something quite nice and interesting about that.
Well, we just heard earlier, one person on this call made a trek just to go see a station. So, and to your point about France, I think France understands that things are built for people to come and see them. And where different parts of the world, you have a rectangular box. I do appreciate the effort made, not only for the practical, but the visual. Fiona, I realize you've just started your day in the West Coast, and I don't want to occupy your day. I could sit here and talk to you all day, however, but someday when I make it to San Francisco, fair warning, we will be hanging out for a bit.
I would absolutely love that, Chris. Yeah, and yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. Great to chat to you and Ian again, and I love the podcast. Please keep doing it. I'll be listening in. I think all of the, I in particular love some of the discussions with the bus operators on what they're doing, and I think the rail sector can learn from some of the innovations that are coming from those bus operators, and that personal touch, I think. So thank you for doing it.
You know, it's funny you said that, because the buses, where I come from, the buses are rather unloved, and I think we've kind of overrepresented them in our podcast, and I'm happy that we did that, because there are some really cool and innovative things going on there to make buses lovable, and so I and some of the people we've spoken to have a very very user-centric, a very behavioral science approach, even in if they don't realize they're doing it. That's the approach they're taking to it. So I really appreciate that. Thanks for calling that out.
And, you know, our train stations, our bus stations, they're, you know, electric bike stations, they're all modes of transport. So, we need it all to work together.
This is certainly not the end. I look forward to working with you in the future, and to work together, come up with some great ideas and make things better for them.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Commute podcast from Boldin Networks. Follow or subscribe on the platform of your choice to stay connected and keep up to date with the latest innovations at boldin.com.